Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with escalating threats from Turkey's President Erdogan against the Dutch government he accuses of Nazism as he cuts off high-level diplomatic contacts and threatens to flood Europe with Syrian refugees in camps in Turkey. Michael Wurz, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress's national security team, who specializes in Turkey and the Turkish diaspora in Germany and Holland, joins us to discuss the worsening quarrel with Europe that Turkey's autocratic leader appears to be using cynically to fire up Turkish nationalism and anti-European sentiments ahead of a referendum in Turkey on April the 16th, aimed at giving Erdogan even more power to stifle the press, purge the military, judiciary, and academia, and create more problems for Turkey and its neighbors, which ironically is the exact opposite of Erdogan's promise when he first came to power. Then we'll examine the Congressional Budget Office's finding that Paul Ryan's American Health Care Act, designed to repeal and replace Obama's Affordable Care Act, will increase the number of Americans without health care coverage by 24 million, making a liar out of President Trump, who repeatedly promised that the Republican alternative would provide universal coverage at lower prices. Dr. John Guymon, a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine, whose new book is Crisis in Healthcare, Corporate Power Versus the Common Good, joins us to discuss how Ryan Care could be such a disaster for the American people and the GOP that it might make single-payer healthcare a realistic option in the future. Then finally, we'll look into the reasons behind Trump's firing of Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and his rumored replacement, Mark Mukasey, who happens to be the former Fox News head Roger Ailes' personal lawyer. Craig Harrington, a researcher at Media Matters who edited the new article at Media Matters, U.S. attorney Preet Bharara was investigating Fox News when Trump fired him, joins us to discuss an impending cover-up of an epidemic of sexual harassment at Fox News. And joining us now is Michael Wurz, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress National Security Team, where he focuses on security in emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. Previously, he was a transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund and has held appointments at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and as a John F. Kennedy Memorial Fellow at Harvard Center for European Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Wurz.
Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Michael. And what is going on with Turkey's President Erdogan? He's obviously a prickly character, to say the least, but now he's picking a fight with the Dutch, calling them Nazis. And the French seem to have accommodated his wish to allow his ministers to campaign for his referendum so that Erdogan can increase his already rather dangerous executive powers. And in general, my puzzlement is, why would the Turkish diaspora in Germany and in the Netherlands want to vote for this guy in the first place?
That is a lot of questions, and let me try to take this apart step by step. So first of all, we have the perfect storm happening with the referendum on a presidential system, which requires a constitutional change, which will be happening in Turkey on Sunday, April 16th. And President Erdogan has been vigorously campaigning for this referendum. And after having had a bunch of elections over the course of the last few years and the country entering in a very, very difficult economic situation, plus the ongoing war in northern Syria, he has really run a little bit out of steam and was lacking his usual vigor and also themes that he could use to mobilize the Turkish population. So he was in a very, very strong position to look for ways to agitate and polarize within Turkey, but also outside Turkey. And so in that context, the fact that he knew that European governments would be increasingly uncomfortable with having a bunch of cabinet members coming from Turkey to Germany, the Netherlands, and France, and speaking to the Turkish diaspora diaspora, many of whom have dual citizenship in France and Germany and the Netherlands and can vote in the Turkish referendum. That was a welcome way of showing how strong he is, that his long arm reaches way into the European Union, but also with a certain calculation of being able to stir up some trouble on the European side, elicit strong reactions from the European governments, and use that for domestic gain. And this is exactly what happens, and obviously it doesn't help that the Dutch have general elections this Wednesday, and it is a very hard-fought election, especially with a extreme right candidate, Geert Wilders, leading in the polls, and the conservatives, but also the liberals, being under a lot of pressure to show that they have strong national and security credentials. So they obviously use that opportunity as well to push back very, very hard against the Turkish government. They didn't allow the Turkish foreign minister to come into the country. They have de facto expelled the Turkish family minister who was in the Netherlands to organize campaign rallies in favor of the Turkish referendum. They have sent her back to Germany. So it's a perfect storm, a really bad situation for the European Union and for, mind you, NATO, because Turkey is an important ally within the Western military alliance.
So then, Michael Wurz, could you say that Erdogan got the very optics, the very TV pictures that he wanted, Dutch police beating up Turks in Holland while he calls them a bunch of Nazis?
To a certain degree, yes. But on the other hand, one should not underestimate that the 400,000 Dutch-Turkish citizens and close to 4 million German Turks or Turkish-German citizens, they have a long history of being fairly well integrated into Turkish, Dutch, and French society. This is the product of a history of labor migration that goes back over 40 years. So to assume that that all of the Turks would be in favor of what President Erdogan is doing is not the case. Quite to the contrary, he had fairly strong electoral support within Germany, but also among the Dutch citizens of Turkish descent. But that is not to say that people that live fairly comfortably in their respective West European societies are in support of him really radically and aggressively interfering in domestic affairs in France, Germany, or the Netherlands.
So how much is the secular tradition of Turkey a factor in this? Because it seems increasingly clear that Erdogan is not just sort of pandering to the Islamists. He's more and more becoming an Islamist, isn't he? I mean, the gloves are off, aren't they?
That is true, but it is also a mixed picture because he had exhausted the support of conservative religious and pious Turks in his own country. They make up maybe 35 or 40% of the electorate at in a good day, but he needs to get over the 50% threshold for the presidential referendum, the constitutional referendum that is going to be held on April 16th, and he can't really do this without expanding his traditional base, the base of the so-called AK Party, the party that has brought him into power in 2002. So he has been increasingly employing nationalist and even secular nationalist traditional Turkish rhetoric to break into the constituencies of the secular and nationalistic parties that are in opposition by and large to his regime. But he has used opportunities with the ongoing domestic low-intensity civil war that is being executed against the Kurdish minorities in the eastern part of the country, and also the increasing confrontation with Turkish military on the ground in northern Syria, to develop a nationalist credentials that have helped him to rally support for his party, and maybe even more so for him as a candidate for a strong presidency, that he would not have been able to gather only 2 or 3 years ago. So it's a mixed bag. He's very, very good at maintaining his base, which is by and large conservative middle classes and lower middle classes that live in parts of the country that have been disenfranchised and disadvantaged for a long time, and see a leader in him that for the first time brings these conservative groups into the forefront and also helps them to develop economically. But he's also increasingly employing a nationalistic playbook, which allows him to dive deep into the nationalistic and extreme right-wing political camps in Turkey. So he's a fairly adept political operator, and he has shown that he can change his political outlook and his rhetoric in a fairly pragmatic manner.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Wirz, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress National Security Team, where he focuses on security in emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. Previously, he was a transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund and has held appointments at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and as a John F. Kennedy Memorial Fellow at Harvard Center for European Studies. But just to try to be objective, obviously, I don't like this guy, like I don't like Putin and most of these autocrats. And I do understand that here in the United States, a lot of Americans voted for Donald Trump, who has, shall we say, autocratic tendencies. So nevertheless, you would think that there'd be enough kind of pragmatism or, you know, a reality check in the Turkish electorate to understand that this leader has everything he's touched has been a disaster. When he started out, there was an economic boom and he was doing well, but then he got and his family got incredibly greedy, and his policies in Syria have been a catastrophe. His policies vis-a-vis Russia were a catastrophe, and now his economic plans are causing tremendous distress. This capital flight, lack of investment. He's in general, I can't see how anybody in Turkey could not recognize that this guy's been the leader of the wrecking crew.
Well, that's a good question, but there are several things at play here, and I think what you've just formulated is the perspective from an outsider that has access to information and looks at this with a degree of separation. For many Turks, especially Turks that grew up in the eastern parts of the country, parts of Turkey that have been economically disenfranchised and where a fair degree or an unfair degree, for that matter, of discrimination took place because the Western Turkish elites would not really take development and economic prosperity in the Eastern Party country at heart in the 1980s and 1990s and early 2000s. And the economic growth that Turkey underwent in the first 15 years of the 21st century, which of course had a lot to do with broader economic developments, the fact that that Turkey was able to catch up after an era of arrested developments within the country, the fact that all of a sudden the entire Levant, the Eastern Mediterranean region, opened up after the Cold War and provided tremendous business opportunities for small and medium Turkish enterprises that could export everything from bed linen to carpets to furniture or even engineering skills to a broader part of Central Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean. So for Turks that live in this part of the country, the experience of the last 15 years of economic growth, of going from people that tell you their personal stories, going from having grown up under very dire circumstances, sometimes in under circumstances where they didn't have access to electricity and hot water, now living in high-rise buildings in two- or three-bedroom apartments and having a steady job, having free health insurance, a tremendous investment of infrastructure. A lot of people in Eastern Turkey have seen a 40- or 50-year development within a decade. And so even if the situation is not great right now and the economy is deteriorating, as you say, for them, for many Eastern Turks, it is still a net win. So Erdogan is still in a fairly strong position. On top of that, he has almost absolute control over electronic and most of the print media. He has effectively neutralized much of the Kurdish ethnic opposition in the eastern part of the country, which was very strong. The army is still conducting military missions against Kurdish insurgent fighters. 500,000 Kurdish citizens, Kurds of Turkish Turkish citizens of Kurdish origin have been displaced. The entire Kurdish political elite is in jail these days. So it is a mix of reasons, manipulation and the fact that freedom and access to information is not established in Turkey anymore is one of them. But at the same time, he still has a strong base. Right now, the most reliable opinion polls that we have with regard to the presidential referendum, the constitutional referendum, is 40% of the Turks in favor, 40% of the Turks against, and 20 undecided. So from an Erdogan perspective, this is still an uphill battle, and it is also for him more challenging than he might have thought 2 or 3 months ago when he decided to go for the change in the Turkish constitution.
Well, I should have, in my litany of criticism of Erdogan's mishandling of Turkish leadership, both as a prime minister and as president, and now he, of course, wants to increase his powers, I didn't mention his cozying up to the Islamic State and then subsequently suffering the blowback, along with the reigniting the war with the Kurds. But clearly, it would seem, Michael Wirz, that the bungled coup, largely by Air Force officers, against his leadership and against his regime, really looks as if that really played into his hands. What's your take on that?
Yes, it did. So there was a coup attempt last summer, which was supported by, as you say, some segments in the Turkish military. It's still not entirely clear who was behind the coup, but what has followed that failed coup attempt, and just to be clear and on the record, it was good that that coup attempt failed, because as much as one might disagree with the current regime in Turkey, military coups are not the way you change democratic societies, even if democracy is under tremendous pressure right now. What happened after the coup has been described, and I think legitimately so, as a counter coup. The president has fired about 45 to 50,000 civil servants that were accused of supporting organizations that were part of the coup. He has closed universities, NGOs, schools. And so this has been a fairly confrontational stand that the AKP as a party and President Erdogan as the leader of this party has taken. And it has deepened polarization in Turkish society to a degree that will make it really difficult to unify Turkish society in the long run, and is also contributing to the polarization that is being expressed right now, with roughly half the population being in favor of the constitutional referendum and giving Erdogan what he wants, a legal basis for a very, very strong centralist presidency, and half the population being against it. So the aftermath of the coup is still visible, and it still can be felt, and it has done a lot to deteriorate the political culture and the well-being of Turks in the past few months.
But much of the purges have been quite vindictive against both the military, the academia, judiciary, and of course the press have been all but silenced.
Yes.
So you would think that within the society itself there'd be a lot of injured people. I mean, it's one thing to lose your job, but to lose your home, your pension and everything, which I understand is what's happening. And all with this sort of, under this sort of excuse, if you will, that there's this fellow that's in exile here in Pennsylvania, Fethullah Gulen, who's behind it all. And of course, he's pressuring the U.S. to extradite Gulen. And it just seems that the one thing that he has, the piece of blackmail that he has over Europe, is this massive number of refugees from Syria that could be unleashed on Europe as they were a couple of years ago. So is that the game going on, and is that what's going to be talked about tomorrow at the White House with Merkel?
Well, yes. So the problem right now for the Europeans is obviously the fairly aggressive way in which the Turkish government tries to interfere in domestic affairs in other countries. On the other hand, the fact that there is still a certain constituency of Turkish Germans and Turkish Dutch that are supportive of the AKP also shows that there are still issues with regard to recognizing labor immigration and giving people the recognition and the feeling that they are fully acknowledged as members of Dutch, French, and German society. This plays into President Erdogan's hands, because the more people feel sidelined and discriminated against, the more likely they are to take up an identification that is being provided by an external leader that provides a certain degree of pride and also meaning to a life in Western Europe, which might not always be the most pleasant one. So I think this is important to recognize. We had similar developments at the late 19th, early 20th century here in the United States, when many European immigrants, because they were discriminated against, would still identify with Ireland or Poland or Germany, because these were the home countries that from afar looked much better than they in reality were. So with regard to the chancellor coming to Washington, that visit actually just got canceled a few hours ago because of the pending snowstorm and has been postponed. But it is clear that the question that you raised with regard to more than 3.2 million Syrian refugees living in Turkey right now, and the Turks having struck an agreement with the Europeans that basically secures payments and access to the European Union for maintaining those Syrians in Turkey. That is at stake. And for the first time over the last 48 hours, Turkish cabinet members have actually threatened that they would dishonor this agreement that they have been discussing and formulating with the European Union over a lengthy period of time. Whether that threat is going to generate any political capital on the Turkish side, that is really questionable because, A, many Syrians in Turkey do not have the means to really leave Turkey and try to make their way to the European Union. At the same time, the border control and also the security on the in the Mediterranean has been dramatically increased. So the only thing that would happen is that you would create tremendous human suffering, for which Turkey would at least be partially responsible. And then also, the Europeans have made fairly clear that they will not not be susceptible to any kind of pressure that tries to negotiate human suffering versus political gain. So it's a very unpleasant situation. Nobody is winning. Everybody is losing. The Europeans are losing in this. The minorities in Europe are losing. And also Turkey is decreasing its international leverage, its standing, and its respect in the European Union and beyond. So that is obviously creating a fairly difficult situation for the United States and Germany, who are not only close allies with Turkey as a NATO partner, but also have Turkey's stability and well-being very closely tied to their respective national interests, because Turkey is an important pillar of the Western alliance, and it is also one of the countries that had to absorb a lot of the turmoil in the Middle East and is truly in a fairly difficult position.
Well, Michael Woese, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Woese, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress National Security Team, where he focuses on security in emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. And previously, he was a transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund and has held appointments at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and as a John F. Kennedy Memorial Fellow at Harvard Center for European Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the report today from the Congressional Budget Office that indicates that up to 24 million Americans would lose their health insurance under the new Republican health care bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. John Guymon, who's a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as chairman of the Department of Family Medicine from 1976 to 1990. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises versus Reality, and What Comes Next. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Guymon.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Guymon. And the Republican replacement of the Affordable Care Act has been scored by the Congressional Budget Office. They released their report on Monday indicating that up to 24 million will become uninsured if this bill passes. So that's a pretty high number, much more than even was expected, I think, by most of the critics of Paul Ryan's Ryan Care or Trump Care.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think you can call it Trump Care because Trump's not out there on the stump selling it. He sent Mike Pence out to sell it, and which makes me wonder whether Trump really has a lot of confidence in this bill. So what's your take on what just happened with the CPI?
Well, I think it's predictable. I think the GOP doesn't have a plan beyond repeal. they're struggling with it. They come up with a number of supposed policies ranging from high-risk pools to selling insurance across state lines to expanded health savings accounts to shifting more power and responsibility to the states and supposedly increasing competition along the way. But that's all faulty reasoning, or as my last book, which you mentioned, The Human Face of Obamacare, goes into, these kind of policies have failed over the last 15 and 20 years and more. I have a new book coming out right now, this week, by the way, which is Crisis in U.S. Healthcare, Corporate Power versus the Common Good. And I'd refer you to my website, which is johnguymanmd.org, for information on that and other more recent blogs about what we can expect of the Republican, quote, plan, which is not a plan and it's really a lie. My most recent blog was done on Daily Kos and Physicians for National Health Program, et cetera, about 3 weeks ago, and went into this a little bit to say how the GOP is really going to fall into a trap. They're going to own what comes out, and it's not going to work at all. And what the CBO comes up with today is totally predictable. We're going to have a big increase in the number of uninsured. Beyond that, we're going to have a big increase in the number of underinsured because the GOP wants to, quote, deregulate the insurance industry even more, including less capacity to keep in line premium rates, including letting the insurers charge five times as much instead of three times as much under the ACA premiums for older people. As I'm sure you know, AARP has come out strong against this. Women's health care is at risk with defunding of Planned Parenthood. This is just the whole, quote, GOP plan, which will be controversial in both the House and the Senate. So we don't know really what's going to finally come out. But what's going into Ryan's plan, which came out a year or two ago, is a disaster. And these are just lies that people are going to get, that supposedly everyone will get access to health care. That doesn't mean real health care. And there's no cost containment in either the Affordable Care Act or what the Republicans are coming up with. There's no cost containment in sight. So the affordability thing is a total illusion. So I'm not surprised at the CBO. They're right on target. And I think it's a sham what the Republican Congress is going to come up with, and I'm not surprised that Trump he keeps telling us it's going to be just wonderful what we're going to get, but no way.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Guymon, who's a professor emeritus of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine from 1976 to 1990. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises Versus Reality, and What Comes Next. And he has a new book out this week, Crisis in U.S. Healthcare, Corporate Power Versus the Common Good. And yeah. And I take it that, Dr. Guymon, because you've had such a long career in medicine, your new book has an overview, right, that goes way back to when you were a medical student at UC San Francisco.
Does.
When did you start out in medicine?
I started in medical school at UC San Francisco in 1956.
Right.
I graduated in 60.
Right.
I interned at LA County from 60 to 61 when it was the second biggest hospital in the U.S. at 3,500 beds. Then I took a two-year general practice residency in Santa Rosa at Sonoma County Hospital. Then I practiced 6 years in Mount Shasta, a logging town up north. And from there on, I was in teaching for a bunch of years, and et cetera.
Right.
So, and well, I did see Medicaid and Medicare come into being when I was in practice in 65 in Mount Shasta. And I can tell you that even without computers or electronic health records, it was seamless as Medicare went into effect. It was a great advance, and the same with Medicaid.
Well, but the subtext, and it's hardly just being disguised, Paul Ryan on the Hugh Hewitt show on the weekend more or less said that his real aim is to kill off Medicaid, and he was proud of it.
Oh, I know he's proud of it, and he wants to privatize Medicare. He wants to privatize both Medicare and Medicaid, which means, and it really means shifting it over to the private sector. Right away, we lose all kinds of administrative costs, which are high overhead and profiteering, and patients get less coverage. It's just no good at all. It's unproven that the private market is more efficient in healthcare, and in fact, it's been totally disproven. The only way we can spread risk across and make healthcare affordable is to have a huge high-risk pool, namely all 320 million of us. If we do that and have a not-for-profit, single-payer insurer coupled with a private delivery system, then we can have we can actually save over $600 billion a year, and all that's well proven.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Dr. Guymon, is it possible that, well, it's not likely, or at least it's, there's some doubt as to whether this is going to pass, particularly in the Senate, this new health care bill of, called the American Health Care Act, Ryan Care. He seems to be the one that's going to be stuck with it one way or the other. If it does pass, though, and of course the president will sign it, will this be such a catastrophe that finally we might have the possibility to get to the rational system that most other democracies and advanced countries have, which is what they call single payer, where you just pointed out the bigger the pool, the more people you can cover. It's logical. It can be done at a state level like they do in Canada. So just in the last minute, what do you think of that? I know it's like things have to get worse before they get better. I'm always leery of those kind of things, but what do you think?
Well, I do think exactly that. I think things will get worse before they can get better. We need the political will. It's a political question. But I think there's going to be a huge public backlash to what the Republicans are going to get blamed for on health care. It's 18% of the GDP. It's just huge. And already the Affordable Care Act itself is unsustainable. And so Republicans will just make it worse, and I think it will lead to a change in the public attitudes and public support. Public support for national health insurance has already been at a majority level over the last 50 years. Depends on how you ask the question, but that is true. And it would have huge support among health professionals who are very disenchanted with how the system is now. And it would have, I think, good support from American business as well. They wouldn't have to have the burden of providing health insurance for their employees. They'd have healthier workforce. They wouldn't spend as much as, like in the car industry, a few years ago they were spending $1,500 a year for health insurance per car for their employees versus $250 or so across the border in Toronto. So it's, I think what you suggest in that change of public mind and political commitment to a single payer will happen. It's just a matter of when.
So, but in the short term, what do you think? Do you think this thing is going to crash and burn, or will it get to a vote and get passed?
I'm not sure. It won't surprise me if it doesn't pass. Mm-hmm. And I think Republicans are going to be sorry they stepped in this mess. even if it does pass, it's going to be an albatross around their neck. And I think it'll make a difference in the 18 elections and certainly in 20.
Well, we will wait and see. I must say one thing, just in closing, that I find extraordinary. There's about 12 GOP medical doctors who are behind this bill. One of them the other day was talking about how, well, if poor people can, you know, go to emergency rooms, you know, so what's the problem? And this guy is a very devout, in quote, Christian. So how do you explain that?
I don't. I think it's hypocritical. To me, it's an immoral and stance, and it is not part of what the Hippocratic Oath us physicians took when we graduated medical school. So I think it's unacceptable.
Sure. First, do no harm. Well, they certainly look like they're going to do a lot of harm, and I thank you for joining us, Dr. John Guymon.
Well, thank you, Ian. I was glad to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Guymon, who's Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where he served as Chairman of the Department of Family Medicine from 1976 to 1990. He's the author of The Human Face of Obamacare, Promises versus Reality, and What Comes Next. And he has a new book out this week, Crisis in U.S. Healthcare, Corporate Power versus the Common Good. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the firing of the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York and his possible replacement by Roger Ailes' lawyer.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. More money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me
scared. Now you left me, there's no healing the wound. Hey, scared. Another one can make us out to be
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Craig Harrington, who's an economic researcher at Media Matters, and he's the editor of a new article at Media Matters, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara was investigating Fox News when Trump fired him. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Harrington.
Thanks for having me.
And is this a case of, because Donald Trump had originally told Preet Bharara that he would stay on as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. And then he was fired. And the implication here is that it may well have to do just that they want to replace Bharara with somebody that's friendly to Roger Ailes, who is, of course, friend and advisor of Donald Trump's. And Bharara was supposedly looking into Fox News' sexual harassment charges. So walk us through what appears to be the real reason for the firing of Preet Bharara.
Sure. And it's important to note from the outset, it's not unprecedented for new presidents to ask for the resignation of the slate of U.S. attorneys who are holdovers from the prior administration. When Bill Clinton took office, he asked for the resignation of 93 U.S. attorneys. When George Bush took office, he asked for the same. When Obama took office, he eventually replaced all 93 U.S. attorneys. The difference here, of course, is the setting and the circumstances of this replacement. And, of course, there is, in addition to having precedent for replacing U.S. attorneys, which Donald Trump's the president of the United States, he gets to appoint his own attorney representatives in all of the 93 districts in this country, there is also precedent for when attorneys are involved in ongoing high-level cases, specific investigations, when they've just set out a new investigation in the U.S. attorney's office. There is precedent to keep that attorney on until they have finished that case. And that's why in the case of Preet Bharara, it's particularly interesting that Donald Trump called for his resignation and then fired him for refusing to resign last week, because Preet Bharara was in the midst of investigating Fox News Channel and 21st Century Fox, its parent company, for not just the rampant sexual harassment allegations and sexual assault allegations that have bedeviled that network now for years. But the case that brought Behara's interest is that Fox, as a corporation, as a corporate entity, is duty-bound, legally obligated to inform its shareholders, because it is a publicly chartered company, it is duty-bound to inform its shareholders that it is involved in these legal settlements with women who are accusing high-level executives, including numerous accusations against Roger Ailes, of sexual harassment and sexual assault and other forms of illegal conduct by the executive team. What Preet Bharara's office believes it is uncovered, and what they are building an investigation toward, is that 21st Century Fox did not properly inform their shareholders about the extent of these legal settlements and the extent of these allegations. Essentially, Fox was cooking the books, or could have been seen as cooking the books, by not telling shareholders about the extent of the legal battles that it was involved in, and about the gigantic sums, multi-million dollar sums of settlement money that it was paying out to these women. It was essentially not properly informing the shareholders who are invested in that company. Every chartered company in the United States has a fiduciary responsibility to return a dividend and a profit to their shareholders. That is their foremost obligation legally. And so if you don't inform those shareholders that you're spending millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, on legal defense and hush money and settlements for sexual assault and sexual harassment violations and settlements out of court, if you're not informing your shareholders about that, you're not informing them properly about the performance of the company, and you're essentially stealing their money from them by not giving them full disclosures about whether or not they want to stay involved in that company. That's what Preet Bharara was investigating, and that's why the circumstances of his dismissal by this administration are so questionable, because he was in the midst of a very high-profile case. There is precedent not just for asking for the resignation, but for leaving on individuals who are involved in these high-profile cases. And in this case, the Trump administration seems to be leaning toward replacing Bharara with someone who is a close personal friend, not just of Donald Trump, but of Fox News CEO, the former CEO, Roger Ailes. The individual in question, Mark Mukasey, is the son of a former Bush-era Attorney General, Mike Mukasey, and he has specifically called out individuals who investigate Fox News and investigate the Trumps, who investigate all of the goings-on at Fox News Channel and 21st Century Fox. He specifically called out reporters who investigate Fox News as part of their profession. He referred to Gabe Sherman of New York Magazine as a virus. And the question is whether or not there was some other motivation for the timing of this specific firing. It also doesn't make the Trump administration look any better that they are involved in this very public, high-profile feud with what they're calling the deep state, which is essentially the government bureaucracy as a whole. To decide to call for the resignation of 46 U.S. attorneys 2 days after the press secretary and the president of the United States have made these comments about how they're at war with the deep state, it does lend credence to anyone who's looking for a conspiracy. It helps them build their case for them without really needing to add any smoke or fire to the conspiracy theorist.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Harrington, who's an economic researcher at Media Matters, and he's the editor of a new article at Media Matters, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara was investigating Fox News when Trump fired him. Now, you mentioned Gabe Sherman with New York Magazine. He wrote the book about Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voice in the Room. And Mukasey, who you just mentioned, was Ailes' lawyer, a personal attorney. And he described Gabe Sherman as a virus. So, I mean, Gabe Sherman is also saying that Mukasey is going to be the replacement for Preet Bharara, that Trump's going to put this guy in as the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Do you have anything further on that? Is this speculation, or is this something that's... Because the other person who you have to put into this mix is also close with Mukasey and with Trump and with Ailes, of course, is Rudolph Giuliani.
Yeah, so it's not clear precisely who the choice is going to be. Right now, it is just informed speculation. But someone like Gabe Sherman is impeccably well-sourced within Fox News, within 21st Century Fox, and he's increasingly well-sourced within the Trump administration because of how imbued that administration is with Fox News personalities, Fox News executives, Fox News on-air personalities, and Fox News former talent and alumni. So when he reports that someone like Mark Mukasey is the most likely candidate to be appointed as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and when there's additional reporting that another former Fox News insider, Rudy Giuliani, might also be in consideration, I think both of those probably carry a pretty high degree of expectation with them. But in the case of Mark Mukasey, you know, Rudy Giuliani is a Fox News personality, and he's definitely a buddy of Donald Trump's, but he's not a practicing lawyer in the sense that you would expect someone to be appointed to be a U.S. attorney, whereas Mark Mukasey not only has all of the credentials and bona fides to be a conservative force in that office, but he also has the recent requisite experience to actually execute that office. I don't want to speculate about who it would be, but it seems like Mark Mukasey is probably the more logical choice. Both of them, of course, are obviously very close with Ailes, very close with Trump, and they do smack of the problem that we see with the replacement of Preet Bharara, in just that these are people who are taking over an office that was deep in an investigation of 21st Century Fox, who have deep ties to 21st Century Fox and to the individuals who were under investigation. So it's not clear how that investigation can proceed with not just with Bharara not at the helm of it, but with either of these individuals heading up that case.
Well, you know, Fox is very much the mouthpiece for the Trump administration. They've always been the Pravda of the Republican Party, but now they're a fully fledged media arm of the White House. And it's worth noting that just 24 hours after Sean Hannity, and by the way, you know, Trump himself virtually doesn't talk to anybody anymore, and he's holed up because he doesn't know how to get out of this rhetorical trap that he's dug for himself by accusing his predecessor, Barack Obama, of being a bad, sick guy and wiretapping him. But he will appear on Fox News, and he does regularly. But just 24 hours after Sean Hannity of Fox News said that Trump should purge the Justice Department of Obama-appointed officials, lo and behold, the purge takes place. So who's taking orders from whom?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why you don't need to add much fuel to get the conspiracy theorists going with whether or not this is part of the Trump administration purging the so-called deep state. Sean Hannity was on his program. He demanded that all of these people be fired, and the next day the Trump administration called for all of their resignations. It wouldn't have been without precedent for Trump to have asked for their resignations at some point in January or February, but now that he's spent his entire presidency at war with the bureaucracy in the United States government, it's questionable to see the timing so closely proximate to when one of his media allies called for him to purge the bureaucracy of people who aren't Trump loyalists, to see him go out there and immediately do that the next day. It really does raise eyebrows, if not raising questions.
And do we know how much money has been paid out to women in Fox who have been sexually assaulted by either Roger Ailes or other executives? We know, for example, the New York Times just recently reported that Fox settled with the former contributor Tamara Holder for more than $2.5 million. She'd been sexually assaulted and harassed by a Francisco Cortez, the vice president for Fox News Latino. He apparently had her come into his office, closed the door, pinned her in a chair, and then pulled out his whatever you want to call it, and more or less invited her to do something with whatever he was wagging in front of her. So that's pretty gross, but that's not unusual, is it? Gretchen Carlson, Megyn Kelly, what's going on here within Fox? To the two sons taking over from their father, Rupert Murdoch, they're trying to change the demographics, aren't they, to get rid of all the angry old white people that watch Fox and try and appeal to a new generation of viewers. Are they behind getting rid of Ailes, do you think?
Well, so David Zerowick of the Baltimore Sun was actually on CNN just yesterday discussing this very issue. And one of the points that he made is that, you know, the Murdoch Sons got a lot of credit for immediately responding to their own independent investigation of Roger Ailes and calling for his resignation, shepherding him to the door. But, of course, when you think about the circumstances of Ailes' termination at Fox News, he was given somewhere between a $40 and $60 million severance package from Fox News. He remained on as a senior consultant with the network. He just didn't have day-to-day control over the operations. And he, of course, went immediately from Fox News over to the Trump campaign. So Roger Ailes was made whole through his severance. So it's not clear whether or not they're really trying to clean up the network or whether or not they're just trying to make superficial changes to win back the media narrative. And what Zerowick pointed out over the weekend when he was on CNN is that you can't just change this culture of sexism and misogyny and of assault overnight. And it's not just one person. You can't just cut off the head, remove Roger Ailes, and assume that everything is going to be fixed. As you just explained, Tamara Holder, who was a longtime contributor to the network, her individual sexual assault and harassment allegation was against an executive with Fox News Latino, which was their Hispanic outreach and Spanish language vertical contained within FoxNews.com. So Fox News is this vast organization. It has bureaus around the country. It has online verticals that are dedicated to different types of content. It, of course, has the public-facing Fox News channel that everyone knows so well, but it's a vast entity, and it's been described as a kind of misogynist cult for years by insiders and by well-sourced reporters like Gabe Sherman, who can really get reporting directly on the ground from inside the production offices over at Fox News. So replacing Roger Ailes won some acclaim for the Murdoch family and for the Murdoch Sons, but it's not as if they were able to fix Fox News overnight. One of the most infamous, of course, sexual harassment and sexual assault violations in Fox News history was against Bill O'Reilly, who reportedly settled out of court with a producer for sexual harassment, for repeated sexual harassment, for somewhere in the range of $5 to $7 million, according to reports. So, but Bill O'Reilly's still on TV. Bill O'Reilly is still one of their highest-rated performers in prime time, and he's never had to deal with these allegations on air. So it's not as if the Murdoch family came in. It's not as if James and Lachlan came into Fox News and cleaned out the storage shed and brought in a whole new face of people who don't have this despicable past of harassment and assault. Many of those people are still part of the Fox News stable. It's just that they're not as well publicized, or they had the pull within the network to weather this storm. You asked initially if we know any idea how much money is actually being paid out, which would draw the ire of someone like Preet Bharara, who's trying to make sure that this company adequately informs their shareholders. It's not actually clear. We know from reports in the New York Times that Tamara Holder's payout, her settlement was something like $2.5 million. We know that over a decade ago, Bill O'Reilly's settlement with the individual that he is reported to have harassed was somewhere in the range of $5 to $7 million. And we know that, according to reports, Gretchen Carlson's settlement against Roger Ailes was $20 million or more. But on top of that, there are other people with active, open settlements or investigations or allegations against Fox News, including a former host, Andrea Tonteros, who hasn't been on Fox in about 18 months since she went public with her own allegations of harassment at the hands of Fox News executives. So we actually don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes, and that's exactly what the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York was apparently trying to do when the Trump administration demanded his resignation and eventually fired him.
And, of course, Andrea Tantaris, that you mentioned, who's suing Fox for sexual harassment, she, in her lawsuit, she describes Fox News, quote, "It operated like a sex-fueled Playboy Mansion-like cult." Now, there were a whole bunch of women that came forth when Roger Ailes finally got exposed. And while Mukasey, who is rumored to be the replacement for the U.S. Attorney, Bahara, who was just fired, who was Ailes' personal lawyer, I also understand that the former campaign manager, the Democratic campaign manager for Michael Dukakis. Susan Estrich is now a Democrat, is now an alleged Democrat, is now his lawyer. But what happened with, or how many women came forward when it was first revealed about Ailes? Because the same thing happened with the President of the United States. As soon as he had that tape from Access Hollywood, and a whole bunch of women came forth and said they'd been sexually harassed by Donald Trump, now the President of the United States. So it seems as if, in many ways, we've got a sexual harasser in the White House, not mentioned with all his buddies over at Fox News.
Yeah, and in terms of, again, trying to get to the exact number of women who have made credible claims of harassment or assault against Roger Ailes in particular, it's not clear what that number is, because a lot of these specific instances, the women are still protected by ambiguity and anonymity in their legal disputes, which are ongoing. But we know from reports from Gabe Sherman and other reporters who are well-sourced within Fox News, we know from reports that after Gretchen Carlson came forward and went public with her suit against Fox News for sexual harassment by Roger Ailes, and then after Megyn Kelly was prodded to come forward and make public her own issues with sexual harassment and sexual abuse at the hands of Ailes and other executives at Fox, we know that in those reports, the term was used dozens of women. So we know that at least 24, 25 or more women have come forward with specific allegations inside of the Fox News ecosystem. And against Roger Ailes in particular, when Gretchen Carlson came forward, there were another dozen or more women who came forward with accusations against Ailes stretching back into the 1960s. So he has a track record as a serial sexual harasser, at the very least a serial sexual harasser, dating back for his entire career. And the spectrum of women who have accused Roger Ailes of sexual misconduct in the workplace spans all the way back into the 1960s when he was doing his first jobs at an affiliate in Athens, Ohio. So the specific number of women, it's hard to tell because these kinds of things are continually ongoing. But we know that there were 10 or more women with specific accusations against Ailes in particular, and that there were, probably 20 or more women inside of the Fox News ecosystem, in addition to those 10, with credible allegations of assault or harassment against not only Ailes, but other executives or other colleagues within the Fox News universe. Just over the past year and a half.
Well, Craig Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Craig Harrington, who's an economics researcher at Media Matters, and he's the editor of a new article at Media Matters. U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara was investigating Fox News when Trump fired him. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.